This is the first morning of the October Precepts Retreat. And it's already so wonderful to be here. And doing this practice with you. All the experience of years of mind wandering on the cushion is coming to fruit. All the struggles that seem so big and overwhelming, gone. Just gone. They'll come back just now, of course. But that doesn't matter. We know they're going and we know they're coming. And again, we just, before I begin with what I'd intended to say, just to say thank you on behalf of all of us for all the Zendo gifts that have appeared, candles, flowers, incense, new shiny moktak, and bright mala beads from Korea. These are just an expression of the generosity that appears all by itself, without self, beyond self. And we don't do it to be thanked. But thank you very much. Thank you. So today we will not be having interviews, we'll just sit together. Start the retreat sitting together. And then interviews will happen out of that. But this is our together action. This is our, this is what we do together. We sit, we practice together, we chant, we sit, we walk, we eat, we rest. And for me, it's always necessary and happily necessary at the start of every retreat to remind myself why I'm here. Or perhaps to remind myself to ask why I'm here. Not that I am finding an answer in the normal way of asking, but more that it's necessary for each of us to just put the question to ourselves. So what I'm saying this morning is, in a sense, just me talking through this question for myself. And if some of it is meaningful to you, that's wonderful. If it isn't, that's wonderful. If it prompts your own investigations and inquiries, as I hope it will, then that's part of what we carry into the retreat. But like everything in our practice, it's not about finding an answer from an anxious question. It's not trying to solve the problem of our anxiety about what our life is, or our need for assurance, or our need for safety or comfort or encouragement. It's more a sense that when we begin to practice, the question itself changes. It changes in tone, it changes in quality. So it's not so much an anxiety about how my life is, how my practice is, what enlightenment is, what Zen is. It's more about the willingness to find the place where those questions change. And the discipline and commitment of formal practice, of sitting still until the bell rings, of coming on time, of putting our shoes neatly, of walking gently over the beautiful floorboards, which were itself a gift from the Sangha. It's more that we take that that discipline and commitment as a tool for enabling our own questions to ripen. Every morning we chant that shortened version of the Heart Sutra and the mantra Gate Gate. And the setting is the Bodhisattva of compassion waking up. And the first thing that being says is, form is emptiness. And if we take that as a philosophical statement, it's a little daunting. Like, is this what awakeness is? I've got to understand form is emptiness. Immediately my anxious self kind of springs up. But let's just have a look at that. And to do it, I'd like to just go back a step. In earliest Indian Buddhism, there was a teaching of non-self, teaching of impermanence, teaching of karma, teaching of interdependence. And all these were part of the way from suffering to enlightenment. The teaching of interdependence was more a kind of a causal interdependence, a causal linking of things, karmic linking. And that changed radically when it met the teachings of Taoism in China, when Buddhism first moved into China, and when the ancient Indian texts began to be translated into Chinese. There was a search for words that would have meaning amongst those who were reading it now in Chinese. So the first stage of transition from Buddhism into China was Chinese people learning Indian texts. The next stage was finding proper Chinese equivalents for these teachings. And amongst the many threads of language and understanding that were utilized in this change were the sensibilities that arose out of Taoism, Chinese Taoism, classical Taoism. And then a teaching like interdependence became a teaching more of interconnectedness, of togetherness, of intimacy, if you like. And the Mahayana teaching of emptiness, that's from later Buddhism, became more of a sense of exactly this mutual being, interbeing, what Thich Nhat Hanh calls interbeing, just the mutual interconnectedness of everything that is so ungraspable when you try to hold it, that it is empty of meaning. And so the word emptiness, form is emptiness, simply, at least here's one suggestion about it, is referring to the experience that when we enter any moment or any relationship, it in fact extends beyond any comprehension at all. We can't point to a thing and say it exists independently and separately from anything else. Everything is connected. The way we see the floor depends on the light. The light depends on the window. The window depends on the weather outside. The weather outside depends on infinite number of things. Everything we experience has that quality of undefinability, which means we can't hold on to it. That as we experience it, it becomes deeper and more unfathomable. And as we experience it, we cannot any longer separate ourselves from whatever it is we're experiencing. So the teaching of emptiness simply means we can't hold on anywhere. It simply means we can't attach. And in that way, what we chant in the morning, form is emptiness, whatever has form is empty, simply means we can't attach anywhere. And that gives us the clue to this whole practice. That as we begin to pay more attention, the solidity of things begins to evaporate. The certainty begins to become shaky. It's very easy from the outside in the world of politics and journalism and opinion to make things appear solid. She's a good person. He's this. She said that. This is right. That's wrong. Everything has a quality of sort of block-like solidity about it. And of course, there's a certain kind of usefulness in that. But essentially, that quality begins to reveal itself as groundless. And as we begin to pay attention, as we take on the discipline of going beyond our self-concern, as we take on the discipline of waking up, of just simply paying attention, we find that the block-like quality of this life begins to soften, and we're in a field. We find ourselves in an empty field. And the field has no walls. And the gates are all flung open. And we can't step back and define things. Or we can step back and define things, but there's a sense always that when we do that, there's a sense always that when we do that, we're losing some of that quality of being touched by the world. We draw back and define, we draw back and like, we draw back and dislike, we draw back and approve or disapprove. And the moment we do that, we've lost that quality of intimacy, of immersion in this life. And that's the direction of this practice. That we make this commitment to paying attention, to sitting still, to looking after each other. However difficult it is, or however difficult it seems to be, that's not the issue. Because already by coming and sitting still during a talk, even if we feel like moving, sitting still during a meditation period, even if we feel like moving, eating the food we get given, whether we like it or not, just making that kind of commitment, already we've gone beyond ourselves. Already we are playing in this field of this empty field. And of course, this empty field is not a thing. It's empty itself, as the name says. It's more like a process of our life, the vitality of our life, and aliveness that appears. And it is enacted, it's embodied. The precepts we've all taken are called the precepts of embodiment. The important thing, the crucial and the absolutely natural thing about it is that from that field that we discover, the action has that quality of open field. It has that quality of openness, fearlessness, spontaneity, naturalness, a creativity, and above all, a kind of a genuineness and an authenticity, almost an authority, because it comes from that field, because it is an actualization of that field that is us, that we are part of. Some of it may sometimes look unconventional from the outside, from the block self that's judging and approving and disapproving. But one of the characteristics of the open field, I would suggest, is that it's not always anxious about approval or disapproval. It's not always fashionable or respectable. It doesn't always appear to be something that can be approved of. Not because it needs to be disapproved, but because concepts of approval and disapproval just don't apply. Or if they apply, they can only be applied from the outside, from the block-like self. Please don't move during a talk. Please don't move during a sit, even if you want to. Okay? So in that space, and that space is not something we can say anything about. We can't give it names or qualities. We can't even say compassion, love, anything. Because those characteristics, have to be authentic to come out of that. They have to come out of that field. And when they come out of that field, they have that quality of naturalness. And then we look at the teachings about compassion. We say, yes, that seems to be a natural outflow from the open field. But we can't always, if we step back and judge it, again, we've lost it. Whether it's compassion to ourselves or to others, anxiety, whatever it may be, there's a quality that appears in people of practice that we can't always define or approve or judge in the conventional sense. It's beyond approval and beyond disapproval, beyond compassion, lack of compassion. It's beyond any words or labels that we may have, because they appear. And of course, the self that functions as the gatekeeper of our life in many ways, that self that is anxious, that worries, that needs assurance, that is anxious about disapproval or anxious about anything, that self has a strong habit momentum, so it'll come, and each time it comes, we just head back into the empty field. We just have to put it down, all the activity of self-concern. And see where we find ourselves. And it's from there that we listen. It's from there that we interact. It's from there that we relate to the teachings that we find. And that's one reason why, as a teacher, one can say things at the beginning of a retreat or to new retreatants on the first day, and they make absolutely no sense at all. But by the end of the retreat, one's listening from a different place, and one hears them differently. And that is the process of practice. Of course, sometimes what the teacher says at the end of the retreat is equally incomprehensible, but that's another matter. From the open field, there's no need to agree with the teachings. There's no need to be anxious about complying with the teachings. It's just your life at this moment. Just how awake is it? If it's awake, it's naturally in the open field. It's naturally connected with every person and everything around us. It's naturally playful and fearless and creative. Or at least it feels like it has those qualities. Not because they're predetermined or pre-taught, but because that's how it is. So when we come to retreat, we make that commitment that whatever I like or dislike about anything, I'm just going to let that be swallowed up in my commitment to this practice and to each other and to this life that we share. And I take on the discipline of retreat. I take on the discipline of meditation as a tool to help the small, wavering, doubtful self to step beyond itself into this life, into your sitting, into these words, into the wind blowing and the candle and the altar, into this very moment, this cough, this other cough, this great sympathy for person who's coughing. Thank you very much.